Hello, and welcome back to The Kicker. I'm your host, Josh Hirsch. This week, we're diving into the world of documentary news. Now, this is something I won't pretend to be impartial about. For most of the past 8 years, I was a correspondent and senior producer at Vice News, where I made dozens, maybe even hundreds, of video news packages and short documentaries. But I also came to it from the world of print. And so I know how video news is so often looked down on by the writing side of journalism. Some of that, to be honest, is legit. There's a lot of mediocre stuff on video these days. And even with some great docs, it'd be a stretch to call them journalism. But in those moments when reporting and video really meet, magic can happen. This week's guests are two of my old colleagues, Amel Gutatfi and Julia Steers. They just took home the Polk Award for their incredible hour-long documentary on the Wagner Group, which is Vladimir Putin's army of private militiamen. They got unprecedented access to a military training operation in the Central African Republic. You gotta see this thing to believe it. We're gonna talk about what went into getting that access and putting together that doc, but also the unique challenges of doing this kind of reporting on film, and why sometimes video is the only way to really tell the story. Amel and Julia, thank you so much for being here.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
I think we start by congratulating both of you on the Polk Award. That's very, very exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, we were surprised and excited.
Julia, in your acceptance speech, you made a point about the kind of journalism that went into making this piece possible, the sort of work you did to get the access. Could you talk a little bit about what went into getting onto the ground with these guys?
Vice allowed us to establish a bureau in Nairobi and really to do consistent reporting from countries that are very underreported in American media. When Wagner was becoming a bigger story there, we were well positioned. We had good sources. Frankly, we had been begging the Wagner bosses on the ground there for 3 years at that point to get access. And then as the story picked up steam, you know, every other newsroom seemed to wake up to the fact that, in fact, the Russians had been in Africa for quite a few years, and it became a bigger story, and everybody started chasing it. And we had asked the previous head of mission there for access many times, even just to interview him, to see a training, constantly rejected, and then had a window of opportunity when the new Wagner boss there arrived, and we started petitioning him for access pretty relentlessly. That's Vitaly, who's in the documentary quite extensively, ultimately.
And in some ways, I think the word that gets used, I'm noticing I used it, you're using it in TV in particular, is access. But in some ways, I think you're sort of making a distinction between what's thought of as access, like just letting you show up, versus the kind of hard work that has to go into really building relationships, building trust, understanding the story well enough to be able to be a sophisticated interlocutor and documenter of it.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it. As you said, it was in many ways years of building relationships. And then when we were actually talking to them to secure that final access, they mentioned our previous coverage. You know, they had been chasing one of the rebel leaders who we had interviewed the year before. And we interviewed that rebel leader in a context where the Russians were actually trying to hunt him down, essentially. So I do think the fact that they had seen that I had reported outside of the capital, you know, really deeply in the field in that country, and knew the context of the conflict, you know, helped in that conversation. I think when other newsrooms, where I had tons of journalists call me trying to go to the Central African Republic and do something similar, to say, well, you know, what did you say to him, and how did you get on the ground with them? And I think it's so much more complex than just, you know, calling up a guy and asking if you can come in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I think on the ground, things also sort of changed. Vitaly, the main representative there and our main character, he initially didn't want to be featured in the doc at all.
Mm.
And
that's interesting. You definitely don't get that sense from the final product.
No, not at all. And I think that was just a matter of him getting to know us in person. Also, the fact that we stayed long enough, which again is one of those privileges that we had working with Vice is that you can stay as long as it takes. And I think that time, we were there for about almost a month. I think all of those things combined helped convince him to eventually let us roll on him as well as his dudes.
Wow. I actually didn't realize you were there for that long.
I don't think we did either.
You didn't know you were going to be there for that long?
No.
In fact, I think I promised before we went that this would not be a typical Julia length month-long shoot.
To be honest, though, all my shoots are like a month long.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It also takes time for you to understand the context that you're in. Like, no matter how much research you do, pre-reporting you do, and source calls you do before you leave for somewhere, you should always be questioning, what am I missing? What are the biases that are part of just who I am that are informing some of my thoughts about this? It's not going to happen in 4 days.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not, because there's so much pressure. It's so hard to convince people to let you shoot with them. There was so much pressure to get, like, scenes, actual scenes, like something that changes from point A to point B, and people going places and people doing things as opposed to just sitting down with them. That actually takes a lot of work to convince people. And people don't always understand what it is that you want from them.
So you're saying you didn't script this before you went out there?
No.
Exactly. Well, and to Amel's point, you're asking so much of people in the field, you know, like you don't want to sort of just turn up on day one, and whether with this Wagner piece or anyone really, you're not asking just to do an interview with them. You're asking to see their life and really understand what they're doing day to day. I think when we did things right, that's sort of what we were asking of people who we featured in our pieces. And so, you know, that's not going to happen overnight.
What are some of the challenges, but also maybe opportunities that come from doing this on film as opposed to as in a print way?
I think all I can think of are the challenges.
Well, but there are real ones, right? I mean, there are scary moments and you have cameras rolling, right?
Yeah.
So I can imagine you're in a moment of some fear and there's a temptation to say, let me get as small as possible. But if you're going to keep those cameras rolling, and credit also, of course, to your very talented DPs, but if you're going to keep those cameras rolling, you're saying, no, we're going to continue to be actively engaged in this moment, even though we're being kind of chased down potentially by our main character at one point.
I always think of it as a third watcher in the moment. So you can't pretend that it doesn't do anything. But the onus is on us to sort of teach everyone very subtly how to behave with the camera present. And so that's on sort of the other crew member who is on camera, like Julia. If she's behaving normal, everyone else is going to behave normal. But if she changes wildly all of a sudden and is doing some sort of voice and is just a different person, then everyone else will follow that lead. So that's one. And two, I think it takes time. People eventually forget that third party or they lean into it. It's a clunky device. Sometimes it's two cameras, like Zach Caldwell, our DP, or Javier in Ukraine, Manzano in Ukraine, or Vergara Daniel Vergara in Russia, or Sergen Stjelkovic in France. Like, there's a thousand different. Mm-hmm. There's that camera. Plus, maybe I have a B cam, a second camera with me. So that's already a lot of things. And then they're mic'd, and then and it's not just a smooth operation of you set all that stuff up once and then it never the technology never fails you, and you have to stop people and you have to, oh, I'm so sorry, let me fix your mic,
fucks with your skin for a second.
Yes,
right?
Can I come really close? Mm-hmm. Can I come 3 inches from your face? Plus, with things that are dangerous or military embeds or things that have some kind of risk level, that I think people are worried about introducing a camera, what attention that attracts, and also the number of crew people that go on these dangerous things. That said, in the Wagner film, we have Vitaly visiting, one of the scenes is he's visiting a local mosque, and or another scene where they're bringing out these rebels. And
the local mosque is interesting because I feel like what you were able to do is not have to say a lot about the subtext because you can see it.
Yeah.
This is a scene where they're meeting with, I mean, it reminded me of Americans in Afghanistan showing off their, you know, awesome relationship with the tribal
leaders.
Winning
hearts and minds.
Exactly. And so you're seeing this, and you don't need, like, Julie, I feel like you didn't need to interject and say something is really broken in this dynamic because you can just watch it.
I mean, I think that's when we're doing it right, when I actually don't have to come in and do a piece to camera that takes you out of the scene completely, when you just sort of trust that the viewer is smart and the cinematographer is good and sort of picking up those nuanced moments. I think that's actually when we're doing things in the best way, you know, sort of less of me interjecting.
Talk to me about the other scene. I know you're about to mention this, because to me this was the moment that says cameras being here makes this whole thing possible, which is Julia, you're talking to a former rebel leader who is now ostensibly switched sides, and there's this whole ruse throughout this entire doc that you guys made that Vitaly has to not be described as Wagner. He has to be described as a Russian trainer or whatever
an instructor.
And yet surrounding you in this moment are a whole bunch of people wearing shirts that say, Je suis Wagner, right? Like, and it's just, it's this visual, right? Like, did you guys kind of, how did you think through how you were going to handle that moment? Like, did you notice it right away, obviously, when you got there? Like, what were your...
Yes, and we had seen them around before, right? We had seen them in Bangui, and already at that point, we had been there a while. So Vitaly was already doing this dance where clearly the messaging was meant to be, we are not Wagner. But it hadn't really gotten out to all the right people. So he and the leadership, you know, they were even taking skull patches off of their uniforms at the firing range and all sorts of things. So we had already seen it in action. And, you know, we were clear that we weren't meant to call them that, but I don't think everybody else got the memo, as was evidenced by this scene. And overall, it was quite bizarre because we were clearly on a tour, essentially, that they had set up. So they took us to what was this field and sort of marched out all of these former rebels who they had been fighting against, who were now on their side, but, you know, rightly so, to these ex-rebels, they were Wagner, including to one of the rebels' leaders, Colonel Kiri, who was now working with them as part of the National Army. So Kiri says in the interview, well, we handed over our weapons to Wagner. And then you felt almost immediately all of the Wagner guys sort of tense up. And then you see what plays out on camera, mm-hmm. which is Vitaly saying, you know, he shouldn't have said that. Did you ask him? Did you use the term Wagner? And I said, no. I said, you know, who did you turn your weapons over to? But, you know, clearly he said Wagner. A couple of these rebels are actually wearing shirts that say Je suis Wagner, so, you know, what's the deal? And Vitaly, you know, Vitaly did not really engage with that. But that's, you know, to your question about that moment is just, you know, as somebody who is also a print reporter, it would be pretty hard to write that moment, right? The nuance in that moment and the tension that everybody feels immediately, me, Colonel Kiri, Vitaly, the other Wagner guys around Vitaly, Amel, getting into the scene as well. You know, you feel it in a split second.
Mm-hmm. You feel it as a viewer. I think it comes through really potently.
So our editor, Paula Salhani, and I have talked a lot about this scene because the mosque scene is a study in how to stay out of that moment, because there's a lot of dialogue between people. And there's Vitaly, who is trying to show the friendly face of Wagner. And then you have people who recognize, like members of the community who recognize their strength. And so they're trying to play it safe. And then you have this one lawyer who's very brave. And I cannot believe he did that.
Say what he did, just for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Oh, yeah. So Vitaly walks in with his crew. Everyone sits in this sort of a hall where people... He's basically like a panelist in this moment with the mayor and other members of the local community. And then people from various imams and lawyers and people from the community were sitting to hear him talk. And Vitaly makes his case. We are here to be your friends. Je parle français. I speak French. We are here to instruct and to assist and to be friends. And
sounds great.
Yeah, sure. It's friendship. And everyone says their piece of thank you very much. The security situation has been contained because of your work, which is not untrue. Da, 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 da. But then one lawyer says, I would like to make one note, and you can sense that he is nervous. And I remember like looking at Zach, our DP, nodding at him. Like, that's, let's roll on that. And he, you can feel, I felt nervous because I was sitting in the back and my heart was racing for him. And he starts saying, I'm grateful for all the work you've done, but I myself worry about getting killed by one of your guys, being mistaken. And he tries to couch it, being mistaken.
He said, yeah, it would be better if you could do your work and not sort of disappear and murder us at the same time.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And then DP shifts right to Vitaly, and Vitaly looks at him and goes, what instances? What are you talking about? And it's one of those moments that...
The we're all friends vibe, like the curtain drops for a second.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then the older gentleman, who I, if I remember correctly, was the mayor, said, oh, okay, haha, he's a lawyer. You know how they are. Mm-hmm. And they wrap it up. But there was this... And that's the kind of scene where, to Julia's point, yeah, you don't want a piece to camera of Julia talking and explaining things, because it's all playing out. And if you score it right, and if you have enough good B-roll of the room that lets you feel what's going on, then you're fine. Whereas with this one, he said that we're gonna introduce you to some rebels, okay, who have now turned to our side. So. Sure, but I don't think we understood exactly what was going to happen. So as the rebels were marched out into the field, Julie and I look at each other going, what on earth is happening right now?
Yeah.
And I think I remember saying, like, oh, we should do a piece de camera in this moment while they're being rolled out. So to express our confusion, because it's not going to make any sense to anyone if you're not guiding them through it. And then Julia, just sort of off the cuff, exactly what was on her mind, described, like, I don't know what they want us to do, but they brought out these guys, and now we're just waiting to see what happens next. And then I think in that moment, in the scene, the way it's cut, you start to feel, oh, this is kind of weird and confusing. And then the score also helps guide you and makes you feel sort of, the score of the scene is meant to replicate the feeling that we had in the moment. But I think ultimately it only works because of how a lot of the shots are framed. Like Zach and I talked a lot before shooting any of this, of like, this is ultimately about Russian presence in this country. And so you need to be able to frame things with Russian instructors in the frame, juxtaposed against all these local rebels. And you need to make sure that they're present in almost every frame so that you, the viewer, understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also the faces of the rebels as well, he did a very nice job with, because we knew, number one, this particular rebel group is very unlikely to have sort of kindly surrendered in the way that was being described to us. So we knew that background context. And then also, of course, we're both wary of this setup where Vitaly's sort of like pulling people out of the line to be interviewed by us, with probably 100 other quite nervous people watching, the other ex-rebels and all the Wagner guys. You know, that's sort of ethically an uncomfortable position to be in. And so, yeah, Zach, the cinematographer, did a great job, I think, of catching the tension on all sides, right? The rebels were nervous. Wagner was nervous. We were nervous, frankly.
Yeah.
And it's a clever solution to this problem, because one option is just not to include it at all if it feels staged. But the other option is to show the staging of it.
To lean into it, yeah. Actually, to your point, it's 10 shoots till you get a very good scene like that, to be completely honest. And it's those moments where I feel very, very grateful to be working in a visual medium, because, like Julia said, I don't know how we would have written that. We've never beaten that visual representation of that confusion and that fear and that just weirdness around it all, and the stage nature of it, too.
Yeah, I mean, this is an aside, but this was my experience, because I, like Julia, I mean, I don't know exactly the sequence of your your career steps, but like I had never done video before I came to Vice. And I remember on one of my first shoots having an experience where something very dramatic happened. You know, a neighbor, I was interviewing a mayor who was embroiled in a fight over Syrian
refugees. Oh, I remember
refugees.
This piece. Yeah, it was so good. Yeah.
And like we're talking about the tension and we're trying to like understand the tension in this small town in Vermont. And then a resident just rolls up in his truck and starts cursing him out.
Yeah.
Like unprompted. And I remember thinking in that exact moment, I have no idea how I would write this without corrupting.
Right. You're just grateful that you don't have to say tension hangs in the air.
I would either oversell it or undersell it. I would never be able to just like we had two cameras. They were amazing. They were these like old Vice DPs. One swung around instinctively and shot the guy in the street, and the other just went tight on the mayor's face, which was just blanched in this moment. And it's just like, how else do you capture this moment but just to watch it?
Yeah, that nuance is incredible, and I think fairly unique in the broadcast space as well. Not a lot of formats allow for it.
I am curious, do you have any idea what happened to Kiri? Because there's sort of an allusion of a kind of threat to him suggested in the doc.
Yes. And we got that comment on the YouTube comments quite a bit as well, which is nice, people's concern for Colonel Kiri. So Vitaly had said, you shouldn't include this. It could create problems for him. And after consulting with a couple different local colleagues, we decided to keep it in the piece, also sort of figuring that level of visibility, which is a choice a lot of people have to make, that level of visibility ultimately would probably help Kiri not disappear, right? Mm. Because he had already said the thing, and then Vitaly said he could get in trouble for saying this thing. So then, you know, sort of documenting that Vitaly had said that was in a way, we hoped, protective of Kiri. Yeah. Colonel Kiri is still in car, he's okay. He's still working with the national military and working with Wagner. And we know that from both local sources, but also from Vitaly himself, who until fairly recently stayed in touch after the doc aired, which was a bit of a surprise.
You know, I'm thinking about that. Also, another sort of interesting quirk of film I've noticed is that unless you're really outright critical and harsh to someone, people tend to feel like if they had the space to say their version of things and they get to see themselves doing it rather than having it filtered through overly digested written bites and written characterizations of their intentions, they tend to feel okay about it, I find.
I think sometimes in typical broadcast news, because a piece can only be maybe 2 minutes if that, maybe people don't feel like they get their fair shake. Mm-hmm. We had the privilege of working in this bizarre intersection between news and documentary. And so if your average piece is, you know, 8 to 15 minutes, if not like this one, a full hour, then and you're careful to add nuance and to cut their bites in a way that is fair and reflective of what they told you, then, oddly, people will feel satisfied that they got their point across. And also you let other people get their point across, but that's fine.
I think that's true. I mean, nobody likes talking to a reporter for an hour and a half and then seeing that, you know, one quote made it into a print piece or even a traditional broadcast piece. Mm-hmm. And my interviews are typically pretty long, so I can understand that. And from Vitaly's perspective, I think, you know, he did say, this is sort of typical Western propaganda. It's not as though he had a shining review for me, but we also showed a lot of what he wanted to show. And we did show those imams saying, you actually have done something good in this village. So I do think he perceived it as more well-rounded. And to Amal's point, we had 45 minutes to do that, which is a gift in many ways.
Yeah. I was struck at the polks. After the ceremony was over, I found myself in a conversation with an editor at, you know, one of these big magazines. And we were talking about your piece and we were talking about the visual components. And I was intrigued by how intrigued he seemed, frankly.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because, and also, frankly, expressing some sorrow that Vice, and we don't need to turn this into a Vice sob fest, but that Vice is gone, which did occupy a somewhat unique space in this sort of news doc hybrid. But I was intrigued because I think my perception, and I wonder how you guys feel, is that video news doesn't tend to get treated as as sophisticated. It doesn't get seen as sort of as well-regarded as print news in general. And maybe the Polks are somewhat of an exception because they include a video category, although they include one video category among a slew of print ones. At least this year, it's changed a little over time. But I wonder if you guys have had that experience of feeling like you have to kind of fight for the sort of respect of these pieces.
I definitely have. You know, I don't want to also sort of on theme at the Polks was the contracting industry in general and layoffs across the board. So I don't want to denigrate any format particularly at this moment because, you know, it's all sort of in peril. But that being said, I do think it's worth, as you said, being honest about that attitude that I think definitely exists in the industry. You know, I've worked at CBS and Huffington Post and freelanced extensively for print outlets as well before I signed on with Vice. So for the Wall Street Journal, some British papers like the Times of London. So I feel I have a pretty sort of broad strokes view. And I've definitely had print editors say things to me when I'm talking to them about, you know, jobs or stories, things like, but do you feel like you can really sort of report or do investigative work? Now, at that point that I was having those conversations, I had been both, whether for the journal or on camera for Vice when I was freelancing for them, I had been on camera getting access, for example, to Sudan's Darfur region, which was at the time very sought after access in the region, and other stories as well. So I'm thinking, looking at my body of work, you can see I can report, whether writing or doing it on camera. And there was definitely a condescension, I think, in those questions, to put it diplomatically, perhaps. You know, it's not to say that everybody has to do everything, that you have to, like me, do movement and video work to be respected. But I do think that those kinds of comments and those kinds of attitudes persist. And one of the things that we were so lucky with at Vice was that they actually gave us the resources that a lot of print newsrooms give to reporters to be on stories and investigations for a year or more. I mean, just shooting Wagner took us 2 years, not to mention all the pre-reporting that we had done. So, and in many ways, actually, I think that what we did at Vice is closer to print than traditional broadcast, which is why those attitudes were always sort of perplexing to me. You know, we have to be deep in the field. It's about the narrative, the journey, and compelling characters, all of which are very important to a long-form print feature as well. So, but, you know, it's also interesting now, all of those same organizations that may have denigrated some of what we were doing at Vice are now doing a lot of the same things, and they're doing long form video and they're winning Emmys. And, you know, I think that's great. I don't think we should return the favor by sort of denigrating what they're doing.
But maybe some of it, and I agree, we don't need to sit around here and call names. But some of it might be because there are shortcuts that are traditionally taken sometimes in video, and at least historically. And,
yes.
And there are a lot of very badly made videos. I mean, there's an entire notion, a kind of now a joke, of pivoting to video, but without really putting any thought and resources into it. Just make a video that's of the thing you did. And so video, in some ways, has become shorthand for an adaptation of the work someone else did in another way.
Yes, it's sort of the one-man band thing, too, of just sort of take that print piece and film yourself doing it.
Right.
I think I've been thinking a lot about that since leaving Vice, sort of which tribe do I belong to? Like, do I belong to just straight journalism tribe, or do I belong to this doc tribe? And someone recently said, take the best out of journalism, which is, you know, an allegiance to the truth above all, and full-on reporting on the story and trying to add something new. And then you take the principles of documentary, which is make it interesting, make it worth people's time, and make it visually interesting, and learn how to interpret all your reporting and turn it into some sort of cinema verite whatever. It sounds very pretentious, but, you know, some visual something.
Are you going to call yourself a storyteller next? I don't need a tribe. I'm just a storyteller.
But it's more just, I think there's now an opportunity to forge a new tribe, which is this combination of, it's no longer this combination of documentary and news, because it's no longer a foreign concept to people, that it's either doc and you spend, you know, years and years with one family doing whatever, and it has no new facts, or like you can combine these things.
I think also what you were saying, Josh, is in terms of like some of the early days of video and perhaps why there is a mixed reputation for that medium is people, you know, you need to spend money and time and newsroom resources on things. And I think there was, you know, a lot of people say they want to do stuff as Vice did. I've had editors and senior producers at other places tell me that, and then don't really understand that level of whether money or time or trust in your reporters, frankly, that it requires to actually make a good video. So I think a lot of things were sort of being made on tighter budgets. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said I think one of the things that Vice did for us that I hope other outlets will continue doing is understand, as a sort of old school print newsroom might understand, that real reporting and good access takes a really long time and is also quite expensive.
And there's one other thing I think that both of you alluded to earlier in the context of this specific piece, but it's having gone on deployments internationally for Vice, and mm-hmm. Vice is not perfect by any means. I mean, I don't think we need to like go down that road, but
no.
I think we can be clear about that. And going on deployments for print versus going on a 2-week deployment to Ukraine for Vice, we often in the video world would do a lot of work ahead of time to lay out who we're going to talk to and what we're going to see.
Yeah,
which I think is a little bit of the it's a practicality, but it's part of where it gets a bad name that you've done a lot of this. And I would feel icky at first about this because I, as a print reporter, had never done that. I mean, maybe I'd
sort of know the story before you're going to report it out.
Yeah. And I think that persists as a practicality throughout video because it's so expensive. But
yeah.
You guys had this privilege in this particular project to just stay for a while and let it grow and evolve. But I think that's very, very rare, even at a place that's good at this.
Well, and as I said, in part, because I was in print, I just said to our senior producers, I'm just going to go to Bangui and meet with these guys. No cameras, no anything, you know,
by
myself.
And then you did it bringing this other mindset, which is, I mean, it's great that they let you do it, but that's an interesting way that you think of that it came from the print state of mind.
Yeah, because you sort of just know just being on the ground, chatting to people is how you're ultimately going to figure things out and report things out and get access. But it's true. Most of the time you don't have the luxury of doing that before you have to deploy with a camera and come back with something amazing.
The way I try to look at it, though, is you kind of have to have a plan and also be nimble and flexible. So like I think the last shoot I did for Vice that was not Wagner was in the Congo, and that took a lot of reporting beforehand, and it was just sort of when I was looking at my notes, because it was maybe a good like 100 pages of reporting notes and calls with different people and people on the ground, researchers. So that's a lot of legwork in advance. And then,
well, that too is reporting, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. That's reporting. Like you have to do that in advance because you can't show up to a place and say, well, what is the issue here? Because you don't have the time for that, because it's expensive to keep all three to four of us here this entire time while you figure out the basics of the story. I try to ask myself, like, what are visual interpretations of what you've spent the last few weeks learning about? And where are the places and who are the people and what are the things that are happening that can help translate like 100-plus pages of reporting into an actual short film? And I think looking at it like that and kind of having a list of potential people and potential scenes rather than saying I have like only these three things that I'm going to pursue and they better happen, because things might not happen. The protests might not happen the way you thought it would. It might not play out in a way that is visually compelling enough or relevant to the story.
Well, I think Ukraine is a great example of that. When we went to Ukraine together, we had read all of this in our pre-production or pre-reporting, had read a lot of coverage of specific things that Wagner had done in Ukraine, reported in across American and British media, that when we got there and started reporting it out, not on camera, you know, we dragged the cameraman around to a bunch of off-the-record meetings with Ukrainian intelligence. Yes,
they get so bored in those meetings. Oh my god.
Yes, anybody who deploys with me in ML, I think probably already knows in advance. But you know, and in the course of these meetings, we found out actually most of what we thought we were going there to report on hadn't happened. So they told us this hit squad that was widely reported to be searching for Zelensky in the early days of the war there, that was allegedly Wagner, was actually, maybe it didn't exist, or maybe it was Chechen, said our source. And so that blew up, you know, one kind of whole scene that we were expecting. Mm. And then that happened in the course of, you know, a village that we thought we would perhaps spend a couple of days in interviewing people about what happened there when Wagner was there. That fell apart as well. Maybe it was Wagner, maybe it was Russian special forces. Mm. So none of what we thought we were going there to film was something that we ultimately filmed. And, you know, we had to report out on the ground and get access to, you know, the Wagner detainees that we got access to. And in the end, we also spoke to a Ukrainian soldier who had been held by Wagner, which, while that was something that had been pre-reported slightly, I think it ended up becoming a bit more of the doc than we thought that it would. And to me, that was a really nice sort of human, emotional moment in between a lot of hard reporting about Wagner. So, you know, it turned out quite well. And
it all
also
became your first act,
of,
right? It all,
yeah, weirdly.
All these things,
yeah.
That, exactly, that you didn't expect to see.
Yeah, we thought we were like hunting down such specific instances and then filmed entirely different scenes altogether and found out new things in the course of doing it, which is, of course, you know, the best part of reporting on the ground.
So what's both of your advice to all of our future bosses
oh, no.
at these places that say, and we've all heard it, they want to do something like Vice?
Find money and find money, collect a lot.
Don't try and do it cheap.
And time, put the time that this kind of work requires into it. And don't expect that your teams can make interesting, thoughtful, nuanced, and visually compelling and nice to look at pieces if you don't give them the money, the resources, and the time to actually do that. And that's time to report, time to plan, and then time to shoot, and then time to reshoot, and time to think it through, and time to edit it properly as well. Like, treat it like an actual field. It's not a secondary supplement to print reporting. It's its own field in its own right, and it takes time and effort to actually make it happen, both from a documentary perspective and a filming perspective and a reporting perspective.
I think that's true. I agree with all of that, mostly the money. But also, as I've said, I feel a bit like a broken record, but the resources, the newsroom support, I think one thing Vice did well is just give good reporters a very long leash to chase down unexpected stories from unexpected places and just sort of trust that they would work it out if well supported and that they would come back with something good or something entirely different than they expected. The other thing I feel really strongly about, you know, as having been based in East Africa for the last 9 years and setting up and then ultimately winding down Vice's Nairobi Bureau, is Vice was the only outlet that was accepting pitches from places like Burundi or the Central African Republic long before, you know, people started becoming interested in some of those countries just because the Russians were there. And I think having people, whether it's a beat or just sort of continued reporting from countries that are unexpected. One, you don't know if they'll become bigger news down the road and then you'll be in a good spot. But also just, you know, Amel and I have both reported, had the luxury, I think, of reporting from certain countries over and over and over again. You know, as I said, I reported in certain countries here two or three times a year for the last 6 years. Amel is about to go back to Syria, a country that she's seen through multiple different political and conflict transitions. And so there's, you know, while I think valuable reporting can be done even on your first trip somewhere, I really think there's no replacing that level of sort of continued investment in unexpected places and investment in reporting from there. And also my last plea would be similarly, just to sort of forget about this narrative that Americans don't care about certain countries, right? We're going into another election year. We're all already hearing that Americans don't want to see anything but election news for the next year, which I think I can speak for every American when I say that is just not true. We're already all
for every American.
For every single one. Nobody could possibly only want election news for the next year. And so, you know, I think as we've said, like the onus is on us as journalists to make good stories. And I think those can be made from almost anywhere in almost any medium. So I think it's quite a lazy trope that you sometimes hear from newsroom management that, well, that just won't, you know, pull Americans' attention. So I would ask us to challenge that more.
Julia, Amel, thank you guys so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. It was fun.
Thanks, Josh.
The Kicker is brought to you by the Columbia Journalism Review and produced by Amanda Dara. I'm your host, Josh Hirsch.